This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Survivor 48 is here, and after every episode, dig deep into the show with On Fire, the official Survivor podcast. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
UB School of Management professor Kevin Cleary is with us on the WBEN live line. We're discussing changes to Social Security, which were announced yesterday, which later this month will include online or in-person identity checks. The biggest change, Kevin, is that recipients can no longer make any changes by phone. What's the reason behind this, first of all?
Yes, good morning. Thank you guys for having me. Honestly, this need for this change has been hovering around for a while, and it's become more acute with recent large public data exposures. The main reason that the Social Security Administration is kind of moving this route, and by the way, other government agencies and things have moved this route already, but the big reason they're moving this route is a lot of the information that they use to verify over the phone that you are indeed who you say you are, unfortunately has become public record at this point. Either because things are just so easily searchable on the internet these days through data aggregation techniques, or because of recent large data breaches where those data sets can be purchased on the dark web. It's very easy to masquerade as somebody else, and with the type of phone voice-only verification, that really was leading to a lot of fraud and instances of identity theft.
Do we have an idea of how widespread this fraud is, that it would give us reason to do an extensive audit like this?
Yeah, I mean, the fraud has been hundreds of millions over the years. I don't have an exact figure, but I think where the concern is that it's on a geometric increase, primarily because of, like I said, these large data breaches that are becoming more and more common. It's easier and easier through a very highly monetized and organized marketplace for threat actors to purchase large databases of this information and just make phone call after phone call until they're able to claim somebody else's identity, until they're able to claim somebody else's Social Security benefits. And, you know, I think this seems, and don't get me wrong, there's some definite concerns here I have. I know this seems onerous at the onset to a lot of folks, and it is. I truly believe it is. But I also think that, you know, the more stringent identity verification having this now is still easier than somebody dealing with the fallout of an identity theft, which could take years to recover with substantial financial losses. And so while this is painful, the alternative could be that much worse.
Still, this is affecting, you know, older people, disabled people, beneficiaries who might have trouble getting into an office, right? Or even can struggle, you know, getting on a computer. So what's the reaction on that front?
The reaction, I think rightfully so, is there's some concern there, because now there really is no way, if you're not a digital or technical native and you're not able to navigate the online or, you know, the electronic verification process, which, by the way, is nothing new. I mean, the electronic verification process has been in place for some time. Then yes, it is going to be quite inconvenient and quite difficult. And, you know, say nothing of the fact that, you know, there's going to, like, as you guys said, there's going to be a lot of individuals that just have trouble making their way to these offices. This is occurring against the backdrop of, well, more offices are closing. More offices are having less staff to be able to kind of work through these some of these issues. And so I do think that's a concern. And while, you know, while I, with my cybersecurity hat on, I think this is the right approach to take. It's the velocity of it. It's the speed of it that scares me at the end of the day. You know, a 2-week time frame is not a lot of time at all, especially when, as you guys said, you know, we're working with folks that are elderly. We're considering folks that have some degree of mobility issue. And, you know, this isn't going to be a nice, comfortable area where they go to these different Social Security Administration offices. It's going to be, a busy operation. And so I do share that concern that, you know, while this is the right approach to take from a cybersecurity perspective, given the speed of it all happening so quickly, I frankly don't have an answer to that in terms of, you know, if you have a mobility issue or a transportation issue or whatever, it's not always easy and convenient to get to these offices. Now, what the Social Security Administration is saying is, look, you can start the process by the phone. You can still use the classical method after 2 weeks, but the final identity verification has to be in person. And so they are taking steps, I think, to make that somewhat easier, but you're still going to, you know, there's still going to be folks that have issues actually making it to the Social Security office.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy.
Absolutely.
You know, you mentioned from a cybersecurity perspective that this is the right move to do. So let's say that it happens. It goes through. Everyone's able to verify. And, you know, maybe it takes two years, whatever the time period is. But it happens. You go through the system. Does this, are you then done? You rooted out the fraud and good? Or does this need to be a continual process where you might have to do this every single year, every 2 years, to make sure that more new fraud doesn't happen?
So I think there's two ways I can answer this question. You know, in terms of the actual identity proofing, that's only something that needs to be done once. In terms of, look, what's the next, you know, are we done fighting fraud at that point? And do we all, you know, raise the victory flag and go out for a happy hour? The answer is no. We can do have the happy hour, sure, but we're never done at the end of the day. And that's something, you know, we focus a lot on in our classes. And when we talk about, you know, corporate IT governance, you're never done with cybersecurity. You know, it's a continual game of cat and mouse. And what our main goal is at the end of the day, and I think this is true of you know, our individual cybersecurity as well, is it's limiting our risk. It's limiting the size of the target on our back. It's minimizing the amount of things that can go wrong that can lead to some kind of fraud or identity theft or financial loss or something like that. You know, think about when you get in your car every morning. We have different things we do to get to work to hopefully limit our risk of getting in an accident. We have insurance. We practice safe driving. We have technology all around us. And so really what it is, it's about limiting our exposure. The cybersecurity risk will never be gone. It just is going to morph into something else, and then we move and tackle that. But, you know, like I said, we haven't declared victory once we've implemented these new identity proofing standards.
Kevin, while we have you, I want to ask you a little bit about this, because we were talking about security and verification and, you know, keeping your data safe and everything like that. Amazon is set to, in just over a week, remove the privacy option from their Echo devices, these devices that have Amazon Alexa, meaning all recordings will go to the cloud. The Do Not Send voice recordings feature that you had been able to enable on all these devices will no longer be available. Should people be worried about this?
Yes. I mean, any of these things that, you know, purport to, you know, record, you know, some kind of audio signal and digitize it and then send those signals or those full recordings to the cloud. Yes, you know, and it's, by the way, it's not just you know Amazon that does this. At the end of the day, nearly every, I mean, really, even all of our cell phones are recording a lot of what we're saying and digitizing that. So, yeah, I mean, there are major privacy concerns there. If you read some of the privacy policies, you know, that a lot of these organizations put out, they're nearly impossible to understand. They're written by a combination of legal teams and technical teams that are trying to indemnify any kind of risk or future use of that data. And so is a privacy advocate, yes, that is a digital privacy advocate, yes, this is a huge concern to me. We have removed the power from the consumer to opt out, which is a basic fundamental privacy right at the end of the day. Privacy is about, we have control over our data. We get to say how our data is used, what it looks like, how it's handled, what information it reflects. And the more ability we take away from the individual who's providing that data, the worse we are from a privacy landscape perspective.
You know, do you see people then ditching these devices, or not necessarily?
No, you know, I don't. And, you know, a lot of it comes down to when you read the privacy policies and, you know, well, first of all, most folks don't read the privacy policies. Most folks, we don't read the terms of use. And look, I'll include myself on that, right? We want to use what we want to use. And in that moment, the privacy implications kind of become secondary. And, you know, I think a lot of us kind of fall into that bubble of, look, I want to use this now. The privacy concerns aren't first and foremost in the front of my mind, or it's not something that's necessarily tangible to me right now. I want to use that Alexa. I want to use that Echo. I want to be able to talk to it from across the room and have whatever music play that I want or make some kind of an order. That convenience is worth it enough to us that we're willing to, in that moment, forego any of those policy concerns. Where we really start to second-guess ourselves is then when we see news of some kind of big privacy breach or data breach or something like that. The concern here is, you know, not only what is Amazon doing with that data on the back end? I mean, they're obviously mining it and doing, you know, data analytics on that to do better business. But what happens when they lose control of that data? What happens when there is a data breach and then somebody else gets a hold of that data? So there's a lot of concerns that kind of swirl around with that. You know, when it comes to privacy, it should be the default. It shouldn't have to be something that we opt into. It should have to be something that we opt out of. And unfortunately, that's not the law. And so, you know, a lot of these things we either need to know to drill down to deactivate the privacy settings, or, you know, in this case of Amazon, we're being asked to ditch that entirely, and we more or less consent to all that data sharing when we actually click on that terms of use and say, yes, I accept or I agree.
Well, super interesting stuff. Hey, Kevin, thanks so much for the time. Really appreciate it. Kevin Cleary from the University of Buffalo School of Management joining us live this morning.